Hi, I'm John Pisanis, and welcome to the Move Smartly Show. I'm excited for today's episode where I get to talk to Move Smartly editor Ermi Desai about some of the bigger ideas I'm thinking and writing about when it comes to Toronto's housing market right now. I started Move Smartly and my own real estate brokerage, Realosophy, over 15 years ago because I believe that more information and analysis helps all of us, both at an individual level, like our home buyer and seller clients at Realosophy, and at a society level, make better real estate decisions that enhance and not hinder our lives. As always, if you want to discuss your own housing decisions, see our show notes below to set up a meeting with me and one of my agents at Realosophy. And now on to today's show.
Hi, I'm Ermi Desai, and this is the Move Smartly Show. Today, we are going to be returning to one of our semi-regular features where John and I talk about what we're calling Move Smartly ideas. These are some of the bigger ideas in real estate housing, Canadian and Toronto-wide issues that we feel, you know, we need to dig into and really get under the hood of. So I'm excited for today's show. Hi, John.
Hello, looking forward to it.
I thought we'd return to part two of something we started in December, a show actually that got a lot of great response from our viewers. And that show was about sort of the big numbers in real estate and housing that I really wanted to get my head around when I started in this space about 10 years ago. I started to learn about things that we covered, like affordability rule. How much of your disposable, pre-tax or after-tax income should you be spending on houses or your housing costs? When in Canada did that become untenable? What those numbers look like? And that's some of the stuff we covered in our December show. Mm-hmm. And I invite anyone who hasn't seen that, go check out that show. The link will be in the show notes and you'll get a good sense of the numbers that we discussed then. So today I wanted to continue our discussion, John, and dig a little bit more into some other key numbers that I really wanted to make sure I was clear on, and hopefully all our listeners and viewers will leave clearer on as well. And for today's discussion, I wanted to turn a little bit more into the demand side of the housing equation. We spent a little bit more time on supply. And we're going to actually return to supply, but I want to start with demand first.
Sure. Sounds good.
So to begin, is it right to think that the biggest number when you're a housing analyst, like you are looking at the housing market, you know, I always hear about supply and demand, that phrase is like, you know, I might as well have a tattoo now. But one of the biggest numbers when it comes to demand in housing is population growth. Just that metric of where we are in terms of how many people we have living in the country. And from that, housing experts do a few calculations. For example, not every single person in the country will need their own house. So there's some, you know, quantification around how many households does that mean? What are the trends? Yeah. But generally, population numbers drive what we think of as our housing needs. Is that generally true?
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, when we think about demand for housing, certainly, I mean, the population growth is the biggest factor. And like you said, I mean, it's not a perfect science because, you know, understanding the sources of that population growth is very important. I mean, do we have a population boom because everyone's having children, or is it, you know, new immigrant families, or is it non-permanent residents who are living by themselves, right? So it's not a perfect measure in terms of understanding what the types of houses we need, but certainly it's a great measure in terms of the demand for housing. And I can't remember who posted, there's an economist, I think maybe it was BMO, someone, it was on Twitter, someone circulating a chart showing the relationship between a country's, Canada's population growth rate and the growth in rents. And it's almost perfect, you know, like when the population growth rate's kind of moderate, rent appreciation is moderate. When the population growth is booming, rents are surging, which is what we've been seeing over the past 5-6 years. So it is certainly one of the most important metrics.
All right. So I wanted to make sure I had a really good grasp on what these population figures are. We're hearing a lot about it in the media, but let's look at it. So I'm looking at this chart for our listeners in our podcast. I will describe what we're looking at. I'm looking at a chart that John has shared with in his writing It's an annual population growth rate chart. It's for Canada. It's pretty basic. It's a line graph showing that since the 1990s, we've been probably averaging about a 1% population growth rate. We see that start to change around 2015. That is not a coincidental date. That is the election of the Trudeau federal government. And I believe they never made shy their belief in immigration for Canada's future. And we start to see that population growth start to climb, ending up at 1.5% in 2019. Now we see a tremendous dip. And that is, you're seeing it at 2021 for our viewers. And of course, that's COVID. So COVID hits, all international travel is frozen. Immigrants are not coming, whether you had your papers or not. The process of vetting all kinds of things are stalled. Then we see the recovery after COVID. So by February, according to this chart, 2022, John, we're seeing a return to 1.5% growth. And then there is an incredible, the word meteoric is used too much, probably. This is meteoric. It by 2023 is at 3%. Mm-hmm. 3% population growth. So, John, what are we looking at here? How does this compare to, for example, comparable countries to Canada? What have we seen here?
So just for, I guess, for viewers to understand and listeners, what we're talking about here when we talk about population growth rate, you know, we're really looking at the growth in the population, you know, in actual numbers relative to our size of our population, right? So for example, Canada grew by, say, 1.2 million people this year, right? Last year, the U.S. grew by 1.3 million. Which country is that growth going to have a bigger impact on? Obviously, Canada, because we're like, you know, U.S. is nine times our size, right? And this is where the growth rate matters. That 1.2 million people in Canada works out to about a 3% population growth rate. In the U.S., it works out to something like 0.4%, like barely any growth, right? So when a lot of people look at growth numbers, especially if you're comparing across countries, you need to look at growth rates. You can't look at numbers because everything's a function of obviously the size of the population. And certainly 3% is among the fastest growth rates in the world. Like there might be another 10 to 12 countries in the threes. Most of those are in Africa, maybe one or two, I think in the Middle East, Syria or something like that. So we're off the charts. I mean, like I said, US is most of the G7 is well below 1%. And, you know, as you said, from most of, you know, the 90s, the 2000s, the 2010s, you know, we were at about a 1% growth rate. So 3%, I mean, is insane. It is off the charts. And this is why, I mean, housing costs are surging, why rents are surging, and why we're having these challenges in our housing market and our economy right now.
Before we get into that, let's dig a little bit into what this population story is about at a little bit more detailed look. Sure. So I already started talking about immigration and we were talking about population. Mm-hmm. So I automatically, because I'm Canadian, I went there. Mm-hmm. And that is because if I'm correct, John, when we talk about industrialized countries, trying to avoid slipping below this 1%, below 1% growth rate. Now, for many industrialized countries, that is because their natural birth rate has declined. The number of children per person, per family has declined over time. And there's a lot of research and factors into why that is. Tends to be as economies develop, as there's more options, the sort of bigger agrarian families, lots of children tends to decline and with levels of female education and all kinds of things. So that is a worldwide trend. That's not particular to Canada. And the case, if I'm not mistaken, John, is that many industrialized countries like Canada want to make sure that population growth doesn't slip below 1% or too low, because what that turns into is then you've got not enough new people to support all the healthcare needs, the working needs of your society. So we see countries like Japan really fretting about their negative growth, you know, Italy, other countries. So when it comes to that, Canada has mainly used immigration to grow. Is that correct? It's not our natural population growth rate, even though 3% puts us in the realm of these other African and Middle Eastern countries right now. Much of that growth in those countries is natural birth rates.
Yeah, exactly.
And whereas,
Yeah, exactly. Us is not natural birth rates. I mean, like you said, I mean, our natural growth rate, if we did not have immigration and non-permanent, is trending down. And I don't think it's so much that countries want to avoid having less than 1%. I mean, most countries are worried about declining populations. Like you said, you know, Japan is a negative population growth rate, which means their population is actually shrinking. You know, most countries, the UK, the EU, like most countries are still below 1%. And a lot of that is driven by immigration and non-permanent residents. And yeah,
sure.
Not.
So, and there's different theories, but there is some concern out there that 100%. What is the right rate of growth you need? Negative is obviously a tremendous disaster. Yeah. You just don't even have enough people paying in to social insurance schemes. It's really difficult. What should that look like? So that's a whole literature and a point of debate, but just wanted to situate that for a long time, Canada was with the rest of its G7 contemporaries. And then all of a sudden, we are now in this other realm where our population growth has skyrocketed. So let's look at this second chart to see what the source of that population growth has been in Canada. So we're now looking at a chart you've shared with your readers. Number of new immigrants versus net non-permanent residents. So in Canada, there's two groups of immigrants. Basically, there are those that have qualified through the point system and will be permanent immigrants to Canada. And then we have another category, which is temporary or non-permanent is the better term. That's what Canada uses officially. And that can be foreign students and temporary workers. And perhaps there's some other cases in there. So we're looking at a graph, again, from the 1990s. The blue line represents our permanent immigration numbers. We're pretty much averaging since the 1990s about 300,000 a year. Until, again, we get to around that 2015 mark, we see some growth. Now, it's subtle. It's not meteoric. But by 2019, we're above the 300 mark for sure. The red line, interestingly, the non-permanent, Sean, since the 1990s, we're seeing that it's actually around zero. It, some years it's a bit higher, never climbing above 100,000 at all, some valleys, some dips, but very, very steady. Now, we see after the rise I was talking about in permanent 2015 onwards, the non-permanent starts to rise. And the non-permanent hits about 200,000 in 2020. So that's notable. And that's before the pandemic drop-off. So again, we see those drops after COVID. Let's talk about the recovery. In our permanent numbers, you now see by 2022, 500,000 permanent immigrants. So this is a known figure. The Trudeau government hasn't been shy about it. They tabled this target. And I believe recently their immigration minister has said that 500 new immigrants a year will be the target to 2026. So that's the blue line. Now let's see what's going on with this red line, non-permanent. It skyrockets. So I think, John, and you can speak to this, this must be accounting for the spike, the real spike. We are now seeing in 2023, 800,000 non-permanent immigrants. We are talking about a level that never broke 100,000 until 2015, 2020, we're at 200, and now we're seeing 800. What is going on?
So yeah, this big spike in non-permanent residents is predominantly international students. And we've been seeing this in news. I mean, recently, of course, the Trudeau government said they're going to kind of clamp down on that. And there's a lot of reasons for this. I mean, one big driver in Ontario is, you know, our provincial government has cut funding to universities. Universities needed to find other revenue sources. They capped tuition fees for Canadians and Ontarians. So, you know, tuition fees for international students are not capped. So a lot of schools looked overseas to drive up their revenue, basically. The other thing is there's no real, you know, we have sort of targets and limits for immigration. Up until recently that the federal government made some changes, there haven't been any hard caps or limits on international students. So basically, there's kind of no ceiling to that, which is why it just skyrocketed. So some, you know, some of these universities obviously have kind of legit, we've always had international students, but some, a lot of colleges, these tiny colleges in the middle of nowhere, you know, our immigration minister, Mark Miller, refers to them as puppy mills that are effectively targeting international students. by trying to get them to come here, pay these high fees for tuition with the promise that this is the pathway to Canadian citizenship, to Canadian jobs. And this is like a whole industry around there. There's a lot of kind of exploitation, a lot of people writing about this and from the communities that have been impacted. And the federal government very recently said they're trying to cool that down. They're trying to make the bar to actually qualify to come to study here a lot higher and kind of clamp down on that. But yeah, that's been the big driver in the growth in Canada.
And I don't want to have us stop too long here because we're getting into the area of education policy and other issues. And I want to make sure we keep the focus on its impacts on housing. But just to clarify and just to follow up on a few things John is saying, when we say recently the Trudeau government's made a change, we're talking yesterday or 2 days ago, I believe Immigration yeah. Minister Mark Miller has announced now a hard cap on the number of student visas that will be given. So how the system kind of works is universities and colleges are regulated by provinces. Funding is provided to all these institutions through the provinces. The provinces, will have international students, always have had international students. My dad himself is there, that's how he settled in North America. He was an international student to the US. So this is not a new phenomenon, but what happens basically in Canada is you put forward the application for an international student. The federal government needs to okay that visa for the students to come. And over time, there was a lot of things added to that. So the right to work if you're one of these students and your spouse and other things. Now, it seems like, John, that has coupled with a few other trends, because a lot of these things were, in place before, but when you have a perfect storm of domestic universities not being able to charge their students as much because of tuition freezes, when you have things like, higher cost for various reasons, the international student becomes very attractive. Mm-hmm. And then coupled with that, I understand there was a problem of a lot of private institutions being given the right by the provinces and especially in Ontario to basically license a curriculum from a public institution to say, hey, we're teaching what they're teaching over at that college. Mm-hmm. And that, it seems, has resulted in some really unscrupulous expansion of the education sector in Ontario. And the immigration minister federally, Mark Miller's called it puppy mills degrees, mm-hmm. just degrees where we are not sure as Canadians whether people are actually getting even the education they need. They may be here for other reasons. Maybe they are being promised, oh, get your foot in the door, you'll get a job, you'll be able to be a Canadian citizen. But without a solid education, you're probably not going to benefit from your immigration the way previous generations of immigrants have. Yeah. So let's leave that aside because we're kind of talking outside of our own area of focus. Yeah. Finally, after a lot of hue and cry, there's a crackdown, let's say at the federal level. Now, we're going to see how the provinces react. Because they're not going to be happy. John, the cap in Ontario, to put a numbers on it, it seems like the total amount is going to be over 300 visas given.
Is it that?
And they're going to be given.
I thought they said a 30% decline. Is that what they said?
Yeah, well, in Ontario, they're estimating that will be 50% because of the number that, because if they're capping it very severely at the federal level, saying most of them will be given to three provinces that have the most post-secondary education systems, institutions, that will mean a massive drop in the number of visas Ontario will be getting.
Yeah.
So stay tuned on that. For sure. So let's stay to what we want to focus on.
Yeah.
Why, John, these numbers look so clear. Why, if we're seeing this spike in demand, which we know in housing is one part of the demand and supply question, why wouldn't housing experts, at least by 2018-19, even before this, let's say, foreign student issue surge, start to notice that demand surge, in this case through population growth, would make a housing affordability problem that the CMHC, our federal housing agency, said was already becoming an issue by 2010 onwards, even worse, propelling it into crisis territory. You were pretty lonely for a few years with your focus on this rise in demand. Why was that? Why does it seem to me like the housing sector was slow to say, hey, we have a bit of an issue and this surge is going to make it way worse?
Yeah. I mean, to be fair to the other, you know, commentators, I think everyone, we saw this surge in demand. We just have different perspectives on the path forward. And most people, colleagues, people in the industries were saying that, you know, we can just build our way out of this. You know, don't worry about the boom in population. We just need to change some policies and we can build and triple our population growth rate. And, you know, to me, this was just magical thinking. I mean, this is, you know, and this really comes down to why I say it's magical thinking. It comes down to understanding sort of long and short term, you know, issues. And I mean, just before our call, you know, I tweeted out because someone kind of responded to something I was referring to. And this housing analyst is arguing that, you know, basically his argument is, should we, you know, cool down our population growth rather than try to, you know, increase supply to match our population growth? You know, like my approach is a blunt tool. Why, you know, not allow people come in here? Why lower our population growth rate? We can just increase supply, right? And this is the magical thinking. The challenge, the reason you can't do that in the short term is that supply just cannot scale as quickly as our population growth can. Like we went from almost 1% growth or 1.5% growth to 3% in a matter of years. You cannot scale supply that quickly. You need to, you know, cool down demand to put in the infrastructure that's necessary to scale up supply in the future. Supply side changes take a long time. So anyways, I didn't agree with much of what they said. I felt like, you know, in the short run, the only solution is to cool demand to allow supply to catch up. But also, you know, I mean, from my experience talking about this for years, you know, it was somewhat risky talking about it. And I can kind of see maybe why some academics didn't want to go down that road, because the second you say that maybe our population growth rate is too high, I mean, the comments that I would get are that I'm scapegoating students, I'm scapegoating immigrants, I'm xenophobic. You know, you get all of these groups saying these things, which obviously is a bit offensive because, I mean, my parents are immigrants. I mean, I'm a xenophobic is a Greek word, so to call me xenophobic is also problematic. I mean, half of our sales team are either immigrants or children of immigrants. Everyone I know is a child of an immigrant. You know, it's not considered, you know, and this is kind of, I think, a problem with the way most debates have gone today, where people can't have like a reasoned conversation. Everyone needs to kind of turn to name calling. And listen, I didn't really, it is what it is. I mean, fortunately, I mean, I grew up with two, you know, my father gave me two strong gifts, which is basically to kind of, you know, if you've really considered something, stick to your guns and say what you mean. And don't worry what anyone else says, you know, and that's kind of why I just stuck to it. So, and we see the, you know, the tune changing now. You know, we needed to get to like 1.2 million people per year for even the most strong housing supply advocates to say, okay, well, maybe that's actually a little too much demand. You know, maybe we can't build that quickly. So things are starting to shift.
Absolutely. So if I understand what you're saying, and not only your colleagues in the housing sector, but I heard politicians also not wanting to seem anti-immigration.
100%, yeah.
There's just seemed to be this attitude of like, we'll just build more. And I want to drill down into the numbers that you were looking at, which made you suspicious about that. Well, we'll just build even more argument. And so let's look at the Ontario numbers. Before we even get to Ontario, let's look at Canada again. And this chart is brilliant that you've put together here. It is the new immigrants and both permanent and non-permanent. So that's in the red line there. These are by absolute numbers. So again, the shape now we're used to seeing, I've described it several times. We're seeing it about a 300,000 people coming in on average since the 1990s. That starts to climb as of 2015. About 2020, we're now at 500. And then we have that COVID dip. And then we see that incredible spike ending up at 1.2. And of course, that's that combination, as I was telling you, of 500,000 permanent immigrants, and then that skyrocketing of non-permanent, mainly students in the 800,000 range. So that shape we're used to, that's in red. Now let's look at this green line. For those listening and not viewing, This is basically as almost a straight line as you can get. The data is showing 200,000 homes being completed, being built in Canada per year since the 1990s until now. Mm-hmm. It's almost straight across. Mm-hmm. So, John, it looks like these two lines are not in discussion with each other whatsoever. There is no adjustment, no evidence that mm-hmm. housing completions in Canada has ever been able to respond to population growth numbers. Yeah. If someone was trying I can't see a more compelling argument as to what you were saying, that supply number is so hard to budge and so hard to move, whether somebody has tried or not. Can you speak to that a little bit more? How can supply advocates see this and be so optimistic that we're just going to be able to build more?
So the problem that they would, I mean, the issue with it not moving, they would argue, and it is to some degree a valid one, is that our entire housing system is not designed to allow for a mix of house types and uses that would potentially allow supply to respond. And that's a fair argument, right? Like, and if we think about what we build, Toronto, the GTA, up until very recently, only allowed single family homes, detached and semis, right? And slowly over the past year or so, the province and the city of Toronto have allowed multi-unit housing. And that's just one example, triplexes, fourplexes. And there are a lot more types of use where it's, whether it's higher density apartments in what are existing low-rise neighborhoods. So, and the supply advocates are basically saying, the reason we can't grow is because we have these restrictions. And that's a valid argument. I mean, it's valid to say that those restrictions exist. Where I think it's debatable is saying, well, if we removed them, would we see a massive surge in supply, right? And that's debatable. I mean, Toronto has removed restrictions on single family homes. You can build fourplexes anywhere. Are we going to see a wave of fourplexes? I mean, debatable, probably not, right? So again, I think it takes time for these policies to kind of have an effect. And the reason many were optimistic, I should add, is that, I mean, this has been the thinking in academic circles for 10 or 15 or almost 20 years now, that, you know, the main barrier to the main cause of high home prices and high land prices are restrictive zoning policies, right? So, of course, a lot of housing advocates sort of take this as a fact. I mean, not entirely a fact. It's kind of more of an opinion, because yes, there is a relationship, but it's not a perfect relationship, right? Yes, removing barriers is a good thing. It doesn't mean you can triple your completions overnight in response to a demand shock, right? And yet this is kind of what has been motivating them. And I do agree, we need to make these changes. The problem is these changes take time, right? And that's why nothing's really changing. I mean, starts and completions might go up a little bit in the future, but we're not going to be tripling anytime soon.
And to unpack that, John, when you talk about the zoning thing that a lot of supply advocates, my understanding and reading of the literature, I would put people in different camps. So you've got the one side that I would say is the pro-developer side. That's mm-hmm. like, you know, if you didn't restrict us as much with green belts and other taxes and really mm-hmm. difficult things, we'd be able to build more. So that's mm-hmm. one side of the argument. Mm-hmm. Then we have something that's been coined NIMBY, not in my backyard. Mm-hmm. So these are a lot of housing associations and neighborhoods that are fighting to retain what they call the character of their neighborhood. And to be really clear on this, this is a big deal in Canada. Mm-hmm. In the Toronto area alone, almost all of the Toronto area had a designation that allowed, that insisted that it was just single detached homes mm-hmm. in the area. Yeah. These are now only being overturned, and there's a lot of opposition from existing residents. You know, we have issues of people being worried that a building will cast sun onto their property, or people mm-hmm. can, you know, look into their backyard. We have issues, even left-wing writers, such as Margaret Atwood, found herself on the other side of a not in my backyard debate. So, like, not to minimize that, but I think you provided more data in your writing that kind of shows why you're still a little skeptical as to why that was the the only barrier. So let's zoom in a little bit on Ontario. And I think this is valid, not only because we happen to be in Ontario, but because CMHC has said the number one shortage of houses is in Ontario. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you look at affordability graphs, averaging across Canada and the problems, the line for Ontario's affordability problems mirrors Canada's. And that makes sense. Most Canadians live in Ontario. I know it's not always popular to say that. We're not the center of the universe. But when it comes to housing, we have a lot of homes. So let's zoom in. This graph here, John, that you put together shows Ontario's actual housing completions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in the blue line here. These bars show that on average, since the 1990s, it looks like Ontario has built 60,000 houses per year. Again, that's not a straight line. You can see some years more, some years less. And that is the trend we see. And then we see the Ford government. So in Ontario, that is the Doug Ford government, Premier of Ontario, tasking a housing task force saying, look, CMHC is saying that our housing affordability has deteriorated since at least 2010. That's mm-hmm. when it started to really deteriorate. How many more houses? Because I, you know, again, you can see them implicitly buying into the supply argument. How many mm-hmm. more houses would we need to build
mm-hmm.
in order to restore some affordability?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this red line shows, these bars here. And John, you've estimated that in order to build the 1.5 million homes that task force said would need to be built by 2030, we would need to
10 years.
In 10 years by 2030, is that correct?
32, like, because they released a report in 2022.
Sorry. So by 2032, so in 10 years. So 1.5 homes over 10 years. What's interesting is you accounted for this as a ramping up. You didn't assume they would build, 150 homes a year. You ramped it up. But you know what's crazy looking at this chart you've put together? We would have to end by this, in 2032, we'd have to end by building over 250 homes per year. 50,000 homes per year. We're at 60,000 a year right now. So what is that? Four times as much?
Yeah, more than four times. And that is basically what our entire country builds today, right? You know, it's kind of interesting because when they publish this report, so this is published by Ontario's Housing Affordability Task Force, and it's the first page of the report. I think it's like their executive summary. They basically said, we've come up with an ambitious but possible target of building 1.5 million homes. I mean, it's fascinating because you look at this and you think these, seemingly rational experts actually believe quadrupling our housing completions in 10 years is possible, and their argument would be it's irrational to think that it's not possible, right? And I didn't think it was possible because, I mean, you look at this growth, I mean, it's not possible. Like, again, like I said, it takes so long for you to see, changes in growth rates over time. And it's totally not possible.
And lest you're accused of being a negative Nancy, let's just look at the latest progress the Ford government itself has made last year, 2023, on these housing targets. So finally, they've convened a task force. They're looking at dismantling any barrier they can see to housing, to building more supply. And what happens in 2023? Well, Global News reported that Ontario has failed to meet its own housing targets last year. The Ford government wanted to see 110,000 housing starts. Now, housing starts are a little different than completions, which we were seeing in the other chart. A housing start, I believe, is defined as the foundation's built and now you start to see the property being built ground up. So I think that's what qualifies it as actually being counted as underway, as having started. Ontario's goal for 2023 was, as I said, 110,000 housing starts. They missed it. They hit over 85,000 starts. But that itself is interestingly 7% lower than the housing starts achieved in 2022. So not only are we not ramping up our building, we're losing ground. Mm-hmm. And that ground loss is 23% off of the Ontario government's own housing target. So not only are we not ramping up in the way that the supply advocates are saying we need to, we're not even making up, we're losing ground. in some years. So, John, why? Why, if the Ford government's saying that's it, no more barriers, no more NIMBY, no more this, why can they not achieve their own targets? What else is so complex? Like, what makes it so complex that they can't hit it?
Okay, so that's a good question. I think there's a few things. I mean, number one, part of this is economic. You know, we're in a challenging environment where interest rates have surged, which is not only impact households, it impacts developers, right? It's harder for them to build projects, costs are less certain. And in the case of condo projects and low rise, but more with condos, they need to pre-sell the condos to get financing. A lot fewer investors are buying properties right now. A lot fewer homeowners are buying properties right now. The sales were at a 20-year low. So this impacts new housing starts. Municipalities, especially in the suburbs where they're building new low-rise housing, have delays with infrastructure because you need infrastructure. You know, but the bigger issue, I mean, so people don't think I'm a negative Nancy when I say that these numbers are not going to happen. The issue is when we think about, okay, I'm going to go on a tangent. So when we think about monetary policy, right? I'm going to go on a tangent. When the Bank of Canada increases rates, the Bank of Canada talks about how long it takes for an increase in interest rates today to transmit through to the economy, right? And they'll often say that it takes anywhere from 12 to 18 months. There is a lag, right? It's not instant. Similarly, when it comes to this idea of supply side changes, there's a much longer lag that is not measured in months, it's measured in years. Because, you know, to ramp up supply with supply side policy changes, number one, the policies need to change. That takes years. If you look at Toronto, what have we done? We just legalized fourplexes, right? I still can't buy a home on a 50-foot lot and build three townhomes. That's against the law. That's going to destroy the character of the neighborhood. So we've allowed fourplexes, big freaking deal. That's like one small change in a whole suite of things cities and provinces can do. So it takes time for these changes to happen. It takes time for investors or builders to look at lots, to start planning, to buy them, to finance them, to get permits, to start breaking ground, and to result in completions if we see completions. Because again, stuff like our fourplex changes are probably not going to result in a ton of completions, right? So it's a very long process to sort of change supply side policies before you actually see homes kind of sprout up out of the ground. It's like years, anywhere from like 5 to 10. It's not going to happen in 6 or 12 months. So those are the biggest reasons why I wasn't as optimistic about this whole, we'll just build more homes and build our way out of this, because it doesn't seem realistic to me. The timelines take a lot longer than, you know, just stroke of a pen and increase population growth, right? And that's why I don't think we're going to hit there anytime soon.
And what's often talked about too, John, about why housing supply can't just expand. You know, there's this idea that you look at the southern states, like, you know, Texas and all these areas where, oh, they just like built more, like, you know, they needed more houses. They went right into their land. They don't have green belts. They don't have any zoning restrictions. So yeah, as many homes that are needed, you can build them, right? Yeah. But we did also see that in the 2008 U.S. financial crisis, that money also has to be part of the equation, right? It's not just land.
Yeah,
so, sure. You know, you saw an expanse of all these mortgages being given to all those people to buy all that stuff. Sure. But when that financial capital shrank, you saw a tremendous problem. So you need land, you need capital. And then the other input, labor.
Yeah.
Hasn't it long been held that in Ontario, does the home building industry even have a capacity to build more than 60,000 homes a year? Well, and ironically, in spite of all this crazy immigration we're getting to Canada, it doesn't seem like we're attracting tradespeople.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're right. I mean, we didn't even go into the labor constraint, which is obviously a huge one in Ontario, which obviously also makes it less likely that you're going to double or triple your housing completions. You need skilled trades, and we're not bringing in skilled trades as new immigrants for whatever reason. I mean, I can't speak for Canada's policies, but they're a very small share. And the challenge is a lot of skilled trades are retiring and not many are going into that space, right? So we're probably, when we think about the natural number of skilled trades, are probably going to be declining over time because very few are getting into them.
I think the last reading I saw is that actually, when it comes to what kinds of trades you designate to attract to your province, Ontario plays a really strong role. So Canada's immigration system is quite complex. Ontario nominates like a certain number of immigrants that it wants in certain critical areas. And healthcare and I understand construction has been one of the ones identified. But the problem is the world has also changed. You know, I'm sure, John, like your own family background story is one where many people worked in these kind of industries, right? And globally, that story is changing. We're probably not going to see as many people coming from these other countries that way. You know, many are looking to skill their way in through, and not that construction isn't skilled, it's highly skilled. But just like we're fighting that stigma here in Canada against, you know, that trades are a very viable route to go for. I'm hearing of a worldwide issue.
Yeah.
That many countries are actually struggling with this issue.
Sure. Yeah.
So the same kind of struggles, if they're having at their home countries, then we're going to be importing that problem too. So I'm wondering if it's just a lot of challenge. Now, some new factors to keep in mind are technology changes. So we're seeing new stories about using more different kinds of materials, rebuilding. The federal government is even okay to book of houses that can be built with, you know, with less approval delays. BC has come out with its catalog of houses. So all these things are happening. But to your point, John, I just saw a tweet by the, I believe, Globe and Mail's architecture critic, Alex Bozakovich. And he notes that the U of T Cities of School of Cities has shown that even though laneway housing got approved, remember that after a big fight? So laneway housing are these dwellings that are in the laneways of Toronto. This is more of a City of Toronto issue. For many years, fire departments and other service agencies didn't want this because, you know, it's hard to access what are would be dwellings on non-main streets. And in Toronto, you have a lot of older areas that have, you know, pretty spacious, what would be garages, but could be, if not needed for garage, torn down and made into a dwelling. Well, John, I can't remember when that was approved. I know you have a particular fondness for laneway housing. It's interesting to see that after 5 years, almost not like very few of these houses were built.
Yeah.
And I mean, there was so much fanfare of that being allowed, right?
But listen,
so is there something also about consumer preference not changing as much? And, you know?
Listen, I think the thing is, and this goes back to, I think, this idea of this supply constraint. Okay, just because you legalize something, it doesn't mean everyone's going to rush and do it, right? And like laneway houses is one example. Fourplexes are another. You know, I remember before fourplexes were legal, like every housing advocate was basically arguing we have to just legalize them. There's like this massive demand, and once you legalize them, they're going to sprout up everywhere. And I mean, I do this stuff on the ground. I talk to people every day. I'm like, there is no, like, very little demand. Like, if there is demand for it, we would see it, right? We would, like, be talking to people who want to do it, and they say, well, the city's not allowing me, right? And not to say that there isn't, and these things are not good, because making it easier to build them's a good thing, right? But it doesn't mean thousands of people are going to rush and convert their home to a fourplex and live in, you know, the 800 square foot apartment on the top floor and rent the other three the way everyone wants them to, right? That's unlikely. Like, you might get some investors who buy single family homes and convert them to rental properties, which is a good thing. But again, you're right. I mean, these changes are good, but they don't necessarily always result in the uptake in supply that one would hope for.
And you work with so many buyers and sellers. So that's what you mean when you say, I would know, people would start phoning me and saying, hey, I've got this property, you know, I'm interested in converting it. I know from my own personal family reasons, I've been considering.
Let me cut you off.
So, go ahead.
The important thing is, I didn't even add, the trend actually in Toronto is to actually buy triplexes and convert them to single family. And that's what I see more
reducing
often.
Reducing the number of units.
Reducing, yes, exactly.
Because
we're not building single family, right? They're more valuable to kind of a wealthier household who wants to have their family home in an urban neighborhood. So I actually see more people taking like older dumpy triplexes, not like amazing ones, and then just converting them to single family. Sort of cut you off, but go on.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lived experience in my own life time as a Toronto resident and person participating in the real estate market. You know, there was times when I had a home that was multiple properties and times when it was a single one. That's true. The conversation is not just because you're wanting to encourage it one way, doesn't mean necessarily that it makes sense. The other thing I was going to say is I'm actually somebody that's kind of interested in now what's being allowed. But luckily, I have a really good friend with the initials JP who's always advising me on the numbers. And the truth is, the house values are so high in Toronto that a lot of these projects do not make sense to convert even for a fourplex. The numbers aren't making sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Still.
Yeah.
And so, that's
why. You're right, 100%. That's the challenge. And that's why we're probably not going to see tons, because they don't pencil, like the returns are not there.
So I wonder, like, are politicians guilty of saying that they can control things that they can't? So they can't control the finance problems of developers. They can't control if developers want to make a certain return on investment. They can't, there's so much that's out of their control that to say and boast that, you know, it's kind of like the economy, stupid, like how many politicians have to claim credit for the economy when they don't really have a lot to do with it. Like, I'm starting to think, is it housing stupid? Like, you know, politicians are claiming to be able to affect way more on the supply side than they actually can because of this formula of land, financing, labor. There's some things they can affect.
Yeah.
But even things like consumer preference, changing labor, you know, it's trades not being as attractive. To young people, things like that. Like, how much can you affect?
Well, they can affect. I mean, the housing advocate would say just because a fourplex doesn't work, well, legalize eightplexes. You know what I mean? Or legalize 12plexes, right? But again, that's a journey, right? That's, you know, it's one thing to legalize a fourplex in a neighborhood. It's another thing to say, well, now legalizing 12 unit apartment buildings anywhere there's a single family home. Like, that's obviously a much bigger
and that's
leap.
Easier said than done, because then you're trying to squeeze that many more units into a smaller space.
Anyways,
like, you can say a lot, but it's not true. Like, it's not as easy when you come down to do the math. A lot of these projects are really, really difficult, and it's not going to pay a politician to say that. That's right, true. Like, they're in charge of the rules, not what you do with the rules.
Very true.
So, right. But maybe, you know, and that's another, like, I still feel maybe there is more they could do if they wanted to, like through taxation of people holding these lands, but that's, but this whole idea of, like, if we allow it, they will build it.
Mm-hmm.
That is being a bit overdone. There's other factors. So we'll see. I mean, I think you've been writing that you agree with all the liberalization. You're actually very pro-density. You know, it makes a lot of sense financially for the way of running cities. It's great. You are actually a densification advocate. Your concern is just the absolute, like you call it, magical thinking about this idea of, you know, being able to calibrate supply so easily to accommodate any level of demand. You know, increasing supply is something you agree with, but you're saying that it just cannot be adjusted as quickly to demand. And that's the truth.
And it's not just zoning restrictions or bylaws or anything like that. It's so many other factors. But
which we discussed. And now I just want to ask you about something else that I'm wondering is a bit of another magical thinking that's coming in. So in response, and I think the criticism of the Trudeau government not seeing how they were pouring fuel on the housing affordability issue, turning it into a crisis through their immigration spikes, which apparently their own civil servants were warning them about at least 2 years ago in a leaked document, saying, listen, you know, ramping up immigration to this level without any changes in housing and healthcare is going to cause a lot of stress. So all the blame they're getting for doing this is warranted. Mm-hmm. Now, on the solution side, I'm hearing from not only Pierre Poilievre, who's going to be running against Trudeau in the next federal election as leader of the Conservative Party of Canada, but other people that are now saying, we are going to tie our immigration numbers to our housing numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have a question for you about that, John.
Mm-hmm.
If it's showing that we have a housing shortage and an affordability problem that was already starting as of 2010, onto which this demand spike was, you know, poured on and fueled to the fire, on in addition to the fact that Ontario is losing ground because of this high interest rate environment, which makes developing homes, like building homes, not great. So we're actually losing ground. All those things combined, am I wrong in thinking that we have such a shortage of homes for the people that are already here in order to be able to restore affordability, the way CMHC is saying, that we'd actually have to put immigration levels down to zero if we were really going to tie immigration to housing?
Well, I mean, in theory, I don't think that's what the politicians mean. But I mean, technically, yes. If you have a housing shortage, I mean, given how high prices and rents are, like in theory, yeah, you would need to do that. I think probably what they mean, and I don't even think it means what they're going to execute, but like in theory, if you're trying to do this, you're at least trying to set immigration at a level or population growth at a level where it's not driving home prices and rents higher. It's not making it worse, right?
Yeah, like it's still some deterioration of affordability, but not that hockey stick ramp up that we saw.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, I just was a little bit like, okay, how are we going to tie anything to anything? I thought, is that the next magical thinking number we're going to see or relationship? All right. I found that really helpful. I hope our viewers and listeners do too. I want to look at another aspect of housing demand. So far we've been talking about what we would call end users. So whether, you know, immigrants, students coming in, they need houses and apartments to live in. So an end user is somebody that is either buying or renting a space because they're going to be living in it. Mm-hmm. There's another category of demand in housing markets. It's the investor class. These people are looking to buy a property to rent it out. So they want this property as part of their assets for themselves or their family. There's obviously capital appreciation as house prices go up, and they usually rent out these homes to finance those assets. And so that category of demand, investment demand, is something that's been of interest to housing experts. There has been some concern, for example, in Canada that foreign buyers are, you know, disproportionately participating in this investment area. And that is true in BC, for example, especially Ontario, a little less so. But Stats Canada has now started to show that Canadian-born share of investors is quite high. So, and I think we all know friends or family friends or anybody who's taken their extra money and invested in a condo or, you know, done things like that. So in Canada, I think the idea of owning properties as part of your retirement plan or other things is not unheard of. It's actually quite common. So that's a concern. And then, you know, there's this fear that investors, they introduce a kind of demand risk that's different because they have access to more capital. They tend to move in and out of markets more quickly. Can they cause mini boom bust cycles and destabilize the markets for all the homeowners, for example, in an area? And in 2017, you identified yourself a bit of this kind of activity in York Region, north of Toronto, where you noticed that investors were buying single family homes at a very fast rate, at a higher rate than other buyers. That led into a run up of prices and a sharp decline in 2018, which I understand caught out quite a few home buyers and sellers, not just the investors, but those caught in the mess as the prices sharply declined. So you yourself have tracked that kind of activity. And now we're hearing about Jeff Bezos and other companies from the US and in Canada moving into this space, wanting to buy hundreds of thousands of single family homes for the purposes of renting them out. So are we right to be more worried about investors, the investor part of that demand side?
I mean, I think so. I think once again, in academic and housing circles, my view tends to be the minority view. Most academics and housing advocates couldn't care less. And I'll explain to you why. So when I say couldn't compare less, there's two types of investors. One is certainly sort of the speculative ones that leads to housing bubbles, right? And we saw this, as you said, in 2017, this irrational exuberance. We saw this in the U.S. The bubble states in the U.S. that saw the most rapid increase in home prices were driven by investors. So investors can have short-term impacts on housing market. They inflate prices higher than they should, and then prices crash down because of their effect. So that is one factor. Obviously not great. I think most people don't want to see that, including academics, whatever. I think where it's up for debate is where, you know, the role of whether they're wealthy individual investors or REITs, real estate income trust, or hedge funds buying up low-rise single-family homes, right? And, you know, I think this is an important question, because I think it comes down to the role that we as people want housing to play in our society, in our political economy, all of these things. And very few people kind of talk about that. My sentiment is, my feeling is that if we're building low-rise homes that are intended to be owner-occupied, they should disproportionately be owner-occupied, right? And they should be, as they have been for years, a home for families that they can buy, that they're not going to get kicked out of, that they can have for their retirement, you know, as their both their residence and a potentially a small investment over time. I do not think it's great when institutions, hedge funds, REITs, and only the wealthiest class can afford homes tomorrow. Like, I don't think that is a good path forward. Some academics will say, well, it doesn't matter as long as they're renting it out, it has no impact, right? And again, this is a worldview I don't agree with. I mean, that worldview is like takes us to basically feudalism, where only like the wealthiest and most elite eventually can own homes, because when homes are already 10 times income, right? In Toronto area, if you can only borrow 4.5 times your income, you need a lot of capital to buy a house tomorrow, right? So I don't think it's ideal that more and more homes, and we're seeing that already, our population growth rate is declining in Canada. And not a population growth rate, I misspoke. Our home ownership rate is declining. And our home ownership rate is declining, even though we're building a ton of housing, because more and more homes are being bought by investors, converted to rentals, and people are renting them. I don't think that is an ideal path. But again, I think some people don't care, but I think we should be, and not that investors are bad. You need obviously investors in your housing market, but the investor role has changed. Investors are buying up single family homes. They're not buying triplexes. They're not building triplexes. They're just buying and holding detached homes in the suburbs, or like our former housing minister buying a portfolio of brand new townhomes outside of Ottawa, right? And I don't think that's great.
And so owner-occupied, just to clarify the terminology, is another end user, kind of. It's the same thing as, is what you meaning there. And in your opinion, do you think we in Canada know enough about investors and what people are doing? Because I'm noticing, like, if you're saying it's mom and pops buying up things, it's these organizations, it's all these, do we have a strong enough picture? Can we say with certainty how much of the demand in any given housing market in Canada is made up by investors? Do we know that?
They're just starting that. Like when I started writing about this in 2017 in Toronto, I mean, no one was doing that. Like that's why my stuff was kind of cited by the Bank of Canada, because no one was doing this research, right? And I think since then, I think policymakers started to appreciate why investor demand matters. I know the Bank of Canada has their own data set, so they're tracking investor demand. I know Statistics Canada through their Canada Housing Statistics Program is. But again, like it's very recent. Like this is, I think the Stats Can's data is like the past couple of years, and they're looking at new housing stock. So I think that's good. And I think it's great that they're all starting to do this, because I think it just gives us more insight into the dynamics of our housing market and what are the factors, and it gives policymakers an indication of where they should be worried and when.
And my understanding, John, is that this is not just a Canada problem. Around the world, I was reading about the UK, for example, in spite of some measures they've made, now the UK housing market is structured very differently from ours. So many different factors and not even comparable, but they tried in their own way to up supply. Mm-hmm. And that means something else in the UK context. But I was just reading that these efforts have not helped. And in fact, getting onto the housing ladder is becoming even more difficult. And in a country where 1 in 10 were once renters, now it's 1 in 5. So the UK is slipping. So they're also wondering, you know, famously, we've all heard about these really rich neighborhoods in England, in London, where at night the lights are all out. Because it's just foreign, really wealthy people that own all these places. And so I'm wondering if around the world, this this ability to quantify investment,
mm-hmm.
it seems like it should be so easy. Like you should know exactly who is using it for what purpose, but it seems like it's not. And why?
Not.
Why so in housing is it like that?
It's such a good question. Well, because it's not for data reasons. You know what I mean? It's for starters in Canada, like if you look at Ontario, all the home ownership data is managed and owned basically by Terranet. So if you're Statistics Canada or Bank of Canada, you need to license the data, and there's rules about what you can use, and there's privacy issues, and you got to anonymize the data. So there's all sorts of factors that make it challenging. And then of course it makes it challenging to figure out who is an investor. How do you determine that, right? Just because there's two John Pasalises who own a property in Toronto, is it like me and my cousin, or is it me who owns both? You don't know. You know what I mean?
For the record, your cousin has the exact same name as you.
I mean, I'm giving you a ridiculous example, but that, I mean,
apparently not uncommon in Greek families, right, John? right. So the data. So, but why are you trying to do this? Do you have to use all these parcels of information to figure out what someone's done with a property?
Yeah, you need to, without getting into, there's a lot of different methodologies to try to basically estimate the number of investors, right? There's no perfect measure because some use mortgage data. Well, that's great, provided the investor has a mortgage, right? So whatever methodology you use, there's going to be gaps in the data, but it is an international issue. Like you said, the UK, they have a big concern with buy-to-rent investors. So that's basically what we have, where people, investors go out and buy properties, rent them out. They've, to sort of limit that, they've kind of reduced sort of the tax benefits, so made it a little less desirable. And that's what governments do. Like the governments are not going to go out and say, you can't buy a second home. They're basically going to sort of introduce policies that discourage people from doing it, right? When I did some work in Dubai in 2017, and it was interesting because part of that work was just looking at their housing market and basically measuring it against international standards, right? So they're kind of a younger country, sort of developing sort of some of their policies. So they want to hit a certain level. And it was interesting because on one hand, I'm there to basically say, okay, these are the things that you should be doing to kind of improve the way your housing sector works. But on the other hand, they were doing things that were far ahead of us, right? Which was also fascinating. Part of it is because they were young and they were new. And they had this massive housing bubble during the financial crisis. And this was driven by speculative buying, in the early 2000s, of people buying condos. And people were like flipping, like people would buy a pre-construction condo and flip it for like six figures 6 months after they bought it. So it'd be assigning the paper. It was that frenzy. And of course, the whole market collapsed. And, you know, they built in better systems to actually track their new construction market than we have in Canada. And they're able to track who's flipping them. And if there's too many people flipping them, it's like this red light goes off. And it's like, you know what? We have to do something. We're introducing something that's going to curb this speculation, a fee for transactors, something, right? So, and they do like real-time policy changes. They don't just sit there and marinate for 5 years. What should we do about this speculative activity? No, it's like instant because their data is instant. So it was a very fascinating experience to sort of see what other countries are doing and in some ways how they're actually ahead of us in some areas of their economy.
Let me get this straight. You as a Canadian was there to advise the Dubai government on best standards. And you were able to say that there's some things you're quantifying here that probably Canada doesn't know.
Yeah, and I told them that. I told them
in terms
like,
of
some things they're like way above anybody. Exactly. It was very, very ahead.
And just to clarify for our listeners and viewers, you mentioned Terranet. So is this not a government agency? Like, what are you talking about? How can our housing transactions not be held by the government?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know the legal structure of Terranet. I think it's like a private company that was licensed the data or has the data for a certain period of time. But
I can tell you that as a former civil servant, John, there's a scandalous backstory to that.
Right.
But basically, yes, my understanding is that it was sold off by the government
to,
it was something that the government used to track, was sold off, privatized.
Which is insane because in the US, land registry data is public. Like it's public. That's like how Zillow exists and how these other websites exist that can track transactions. It's public information. It's not held by some private corp that charges you an arm and a leg to access land registry data. So it's we're a bit backwards here.
All right. Well, I feel like we have a stronger sense of some numbers. We also are learning that there's some numbers that we should, as at least government and as a society, have a better idea around. What do you think, after years and years of working in this space, do you think overall our ability as a society and led by our governments and our institutions is improving in Canada, that we, through this latest crisis? I mean, it's hard to talk about this when we've just experienced an absolute, I mean, I don't want to swear, but S show of how not to manage demand and supply. We now see some backtracking in Ottawa, but do you feel it's getting better?
I mean, not really. I mean, I think getting better, I mean, so our federal government's doing stuff to curb international students and the exploitation. I mean, did we really need to get to this crisis point? Like, these red flags were there before, you know what I mean? So I'm not overly optimistic. We're like in damage control. You know, so I don't know. I'm not overly optimistic. I think a lot of the, again, a lot of the policy people on housing remain relatively indifferent to demand. You know, I think this has now become politically popular because we hit 1.2 million. It's obvious we can't build this much. So yes, they're fine with the student stuff, but I don't know. I'm kind of mixed. I don't see a lot of people's, I don't know. I'm not overly optimistic. I think there's going to be challenges. I think our population growth rate is going to still be much higher than our ability to build for some time. And I think that's going to put pressure on housing and especially rents.
All right. Well, we can only do our part, which is try to point out and zero in on some of the numbers that matter. Well, listen, you know, I know you're very humble, and I know you don't like when people say this, but I do feel I witnessed you being a front runner in raising the alarm, the issue around the mismatch between supply and demand. And I saw people, you know, say those unhurtful things about why you're, you know, questioning your motivations for doing so. I know you personally are very pro immigration, diversity, everybody deserves a chance. So that I'm sure was hurtful. So I do think, in my estimation, that we do know a bit more about the numbers around what we should be seeing, thanks to efforts like you, from you and your colleagues. So keep it up. Don't be discouraged.
Thank you for finishing on a more positive note.
All right. Well, this was great. Please, if you enjoyed this, or if you have some feedback, let us know about it. John, where can people reach you?
Ask John at movesmartly.com.
You can reach me at editor@movesmartly.com. We're also at movesmartly on X. John, you're at John Pasalis on X, formerly Twitter. And yes, please let us know what you think of the show. And if you found it useful, please continue to like, subscribe, and share the show with your friends and family. Thank you for watching, and we will talk to you soon.
Till next time.